Hi everyone, my name is Hallie Applebaum and I'm the founder of Future of Women. Today we're speaking with our friends Kiran Gandhi, who performs as Madame Gandhi, and Sana Javeri Khatri. Kiran will be speaking with Sana about Sana's work with Indian farmers and the recent farmer protests in India.
Sana, I miss you so much. It's so good to be on this podcast with you and to be hosting this with you as news is taking over with the farmer protests in India. Your work with diaspora has always inspired me. I have your Halbi powder, aka turmeric, in my downtown Los Angeles cabinet to this day. In fact, I have two jars of it because it's like part of my daily ritual. Your holistic practice and awareness of how these products are reaching the rest of the world, how to do it sustainably, how to be aware of where we're sourcing all these products, especially as Indian agricultural resources have exploded all over the wellness market in the Western world. Your consciousness and the activism that you're doing around it is so inspiring to me. So thank you again for letting us interview you about what's happening in India.
Thank you. Yeah, I miss seeing you in random cities and random times like Bombay, LA, New York. I never know when we're going to run into each other. I don't think people know, but I was an OG Madame Gandhi photographer before I started Diaspora Co. So we go way back. So clearly I've been a fan for a long time. But yeah, in terms of what's going on in India right now, I have worked in Indian agriculture for the past 5 years, pretty deeply working and sourcing from small organic Indian farmers and sourcing really, really high quality spices for my company, Diaspora Co. But the farmers protest, what's going on right now, I will get into how this affects our farm partners later on. But I think what's most important and what people are really wondering right now is, why is this happening? What does the agricultural system of India even look like? The bills are very confusingly worded. It's very hard to get your handle over what is going on and why people are protesting. What I wanted to go into is the fact that it really begins with the Green Revolution in the 60s.
Okay, so pause right there. Yeah. Before we go to the 60s, do you think you could set the stage for someone who hasn't even heard about what's happening? Can you tell us what's currently happening in India right now?
Yes. So to back it up, for the past 3 weeks now, over 250 million farmers and daily wage laborers have gathered from all over the country, but primarily North India, Punjab, Rajasthan, and Haryana, have all been gathering in Delhi to protest these three farm bills. And the three farm bills were pushed through under pretty contentious circumstances by the governing party, the BJP, back in September. So the protests have actually been happening since September, but it was only a few weeks ago that farmers said, you know what, if nobody's going to listen to us, we're going to march on the Capitol and we're going to march to the Capitol. And the police have actually been blocking the farmers from entering the Capitol. And so right now, the majority of the protest is happening at the Singhu border, where the police had barricaded the farmers and said, you cannot come any further. And so the farmers are like, cool, you're not going to let us further. Like, we're going to take over the highways. And I think when people talk about the farmer protests, folks are like, oh, tens of thousands of people, or like thousands of people. It's like 250 million. This is the largest.
That's pretty much the population of the United
States.
The US population is 330 million. So that's over half the population.
Right. And like that scale is not imaginable, I think, to a lot of Westerners of how many that is. And so it's primarily folks from North India, Punjab, Haryana, and Rajasthan, but it is spreading into a movement across the country because it is turning into a larger movement around agricultural reform that has never really happened. Like, there was the hope that post-independence in India, which is now 80 years ago, there would be this kind of new wave of farm sovereignty and farmer sovereignty, and that has never happened. It's been repeatedly blocked. And so I'm really hopeful that this is going to turn into a movement for farmer equality across the country. We can get into what that looks like, et cetera, later on, but it's quite a moment. And a big reason that you're not seeing coverage of it in the Western media is because you're not seeing coverage of it even really in Indian media in an unbiased way. And that's really because Indian media is owned at this point by corporations and really under the thumb of the ruling party under the BJP. So like, Jio, which is run by Reliance, stands to profit hugely by these farm deals. So does pretty much every other Indian media outlet. They're all owned by conglomerates that will profit hugely from these bills, which means that it's not in their interest to cover this in an unbiased manner, which further deepens this point about corporate consolidation and how we're at a kind of tipping point in India right now where we stand to end up with a bunch of oligarchies.
Your knowledge on this is so brilliant. I have one question right off the bat before we dive into the back history of the protests right now. My question is, what does the bias coverage look like? What is sort of the narrative around those who oppose the farmer protests in India right now?
It's primarily that these are pro-farmer policies, that the farmers don't know it. Yeah, isn't that rich? Honestly, it's easy for me to bash on the governing party, but like I have heard this rhetoric in some form from folks who are actually not even pro-BJP, just because when you see it in all forms of media so continuously, reinforced in WhatsApp forwards, reinforced in every corner of your life, you start to believe it. So the rhetoric is largely that these laws get rid of the middleman and allow the farmer to directly sell to companies and corporations. As a company, personally, myself, who buys directly from farmers, on the outset, like people are like, well, that's really hypocritical of you. You know, you support direct trade. But what they're not understanding is that the way these bills are set up is so that there's no checks and balances in place. There's no protection.
That protects the farmer.
So I'm obviously the outlier of like the woo-woo super equitable corporation that's championing to pay the farmer more. But obviously I'm in the like 0.001%. And so as things stand, these bills would allow corporations to eventually, first year, maybe all good. Farmers work directly with the farmers. But like by year two and three, the corporations become the price setters instead of the farmers, at which point we start to see price gouging of the farmers.
Wow. Wow. So how would this affect your business directly? And how, as a business owner, do you navigate the ethics of where you source your product from compared to the sort of traditional American, let's say, way of doing business, which is making your profits, expanding your business, scaling, pushing, and being competitive with other companies who are not sourcing their products in an ethical way? And where does the consumer play a role in all of that? Sorry if that's multiple.
No, I love it.
As an MBA, I'm always like, let's bring ethics into the conversation where people think that doing business requires a degree of exploitation. Like,
absolutely.
I really want to believe that that's just the worst way you could do business.
Amen. Yeah, I think actually to answer that question, that leads in really well into the gender conversation, which is, currently, if you look at photos of the protests, you are largely seeing men at the helm of it. And I've been getting a lot of questions of like, why are men the face of this protest? And
but I see women, I see the pictures, like half the pictures are all women and then the other half of the pictures are all men. They seem to be separated by gender.
So women that you're seeing in images, and it's largely scrolls images of one protest, which is off the farmers' mothers and wives who were in a separate tent at one protest. So the images are a little bit skewed. Like people are, myself included, like we are sharing the images of the women a lot because we want the women to have visibility. What's important to note here is that 99 or 8%, especially in North India, farmland is owned by men. So even though the workforce of a farm, so farm labor, will then be 90% women, those are migrant workers. Those are daily wage workers. Those are not farm owners. This protest, whilst it will grow and is growing into being farm workers as well, it was started and led by landowners and farm owners. Men hold ownership. That's unfortunately just a sad reality. When folks ask us, how many women do you guys work with at diaspora? I say, well, we work with actually over 500 women, but only two of them are actually farm owners and in positions of power. Diaspora's health insurance program was born out of wanting to provide the women in our supply chain with some security because they clearly didn't have the same amount of security given that men seem to hold all the power. Within our supply chain, women are either the weakest link or me, the owner. Like those are the two spectrum of women in my supply chain. Everything in between, from the farm worker onwards up until me, it's run by men. When you're looking at our farmers, one, they're already somewhat privileged in that they're men. Two, we only work with farm partners that are 100% organic or pesticide free. So they're probably landowning because they have been able to take their plot of land, take a risk, which is growing without pesticides, and grow it organically, at least for the first year with no guarantee of a market, like just take a chance and grow something organically. Then once they find us, that risk is rewarded because we pay them a premium, a significant premium, 6x. And, you know, they can sell direct to us. They don't have to deal with any middlemen.
And they enjoy it. And they
of
want
course. To. And, you know, it's a long-term deep relationship that we build. Yeah.
Correct.
But like correct. They are already landowning, they're already men, and they're already wealthy enough usually to have been able to take that risk of potentially losing an organic crop. So our farm partners will not be affected by this law in any way, but that's because they are, to give an American comparison, they are like the coastal elite small organic farms that you and me buy from at the Hollywood Farmers Market or the Union Square Farmers Market, not mm-hmm. the heartland of America, the soy and corn farmers of the Midwest. That's an important comparison and distinction to make. And most of our farm partners are also in South India, which is very, very different because South India was not as deeply affected by the Green Revolution in the 60s and not forced in a way, forced or coerced or pushed towards growing high yielding GMO rice and wheat in the 60s, which mm-hmm. was primarily North Indian. So especially in Punjab.
This is perfect. Are you about to segue into Yeah, please do. Please do. Because for those who are listening, before we had started this, we were connecting a little bit and Sana was telling me that she had written, sorry, tell me your pronouns again.
My pronouns are she, her. Thanks for asking.
Perfect. And mine are as well. So Sana was just telling me that her thesis was about the Green Revolution in India, which really sets the stage for the current farmers' protest. And I really was kind of intuitively feeling there has to be a backstory to have enabled something like this to reach the scale and the kind of empowerment that it is. I'm really excited to kind of hear your perspective on what happened in the 60s and how that is affecting where we're at
right
now.
So in the 60s, you know, this is like peak industrial ag as the answer to everything in the West that was being pushed into India as the answer largely to starvation and food insecurity. And the idea that if India were to, and it's a very patriarchal Western charitable ideology of like, as long as they have grain, like as long as they can grow themselves a bowl of wheat, like they will be okay and they will not starve, instead of the recognition that there are indigenous grains, indigenous millets, leafy green vegetables. Like there's a whole repertoire of super climate resistant food that the subcontinent has grown for hundreds of years that could have fed the country. But instead, there was this push from the West to grow high yielding, sometimes GMO, largely GMO, wheat and rice in Punjab and Haryana and Rajasthan, largely Punjab. And that's when the conversation became about Punjab as the grain bowl of India. And in a way, those farmers at the time were really rising to the occasion, right? They were saying, okay, we have the land. You are giving us the seed. You are saying we need to feed the country. Chalo, we'll feed the country. And they were rewarded for that, which meant that for growing these high yielding varieties, they started to make a good living. And the hope was that this would push them into becoming middle class or upper class farmers and create this high value farming elite almost who were responsible for producing the bulk of the grain. The short-sightedness of that is that those high-yielding varieties were not suited to the climate. More and more water started being pulled up via wells. The people who had the ability to borrow more money for deeper wells had more irrigation and therefore had more wheat. These farmers who were tasked in the 60s with feeding the nation were rewarded in that they were given higher prices. And so if you look at the average income of a Punjabi wheat farmer or grain farmer compared to a Bihari farmer, a farmer in Bihar makes about 3,000 rupees a month, which is nothing. That is like so, so far below the poverty line. Whereas a Punjabi grain farmer makes anywhere from 18,000 to 23,000 a month. Still not much to take home. But, and what's important to like mention here is that that Punjabi grain farmer, his inputs, like what he has to pay in his water bill, what he has to pay for the tractors, what he has to pay for all the fertilizers that have been shoved at him, what he has to pay to buy new grain seeds every year, those inputs might add up to probably even more than he makes. So there's this assumption that he's making a lot of money, but he's also getting further and further into debt, especially as the cost of the inputs rise and access to water becomes more and more scarce. So has his quality of life over the past 60 years in a way gone up? Yes. But is he deeply in debt? Also, yes. Does that mean he is not more privileged than the Bihari farmer? He is still, of course, more privileged because he has access to capital that the Bihari farmer doesn't have, but he's just as screwed. So across the states, there's resentment for the green farmers in the north. Everybody's been playing the game really differently and had access to very different resources. The way a South Indian rice farmer interacts with the government, interacts with the market is completely different from these Punjabi farmers. We should backtrack to what are the bills really doing? What is the current system and what are they undoing? Currently, a grain farmer sells his harvest at a mandi. A mandi is kind of like an auction house, a government-led middleman. And at the mandi, there's an MSP, a minimum sale price or selling price that's set by the government that allows the farmer to know at the beginning of the season, if he harvests this much, this is going to be his income for the year. And that allows him to financially plan to an extent. What then happens is if there is too much grain grown, but the MSP was already set, the government will still buy all the grain from the farmer and hoard it and keep it either to give out as, you know, part of subsidies or give free grain to people that need it. But a lot of the time what happens is that the government buys all this surplus grain, it gets stored. The next year there's another bumper crop and the previous year's harvest that was bought and stored by the government goes completely to waste or is rotted. And so it is not an efficient system. It's a system with a lot of issues. It's a system that is creating, in a way, a dependence on the government. And in this way, corporations have to interact with the middlemen and with the government in order to buy grain. What the new ruling does is it takes out the MSP system and it takes out the system. So a corporation can go straight to the farmer and say, you know, this is how much I need, and essentially do contract farming, and the farmer sells directly to the corporation. The fear is that with these grain farmers, grain, or at least high yielding varieties of rice and wheat, take such high inputs that if they can't guarantee what price they're going to get for their crop, they don't know if it's going to be even worth growing. We've all heard the stories of people dumping out their entire crop because it's not worth the money to even harvest it. That's a big fear for these kinds of farmers. The other big fear is that over time, these corporations will come to them and say, you know, well, we already have this much, we only need this much more, and this is the price we're willing to offer. And it will no longer matter whether that's a price that actually covers the farmer's costs. The corporation becomes the price setter. So that's the fear. Obviously, what the ruling government is saying is that these laws were set up to help the farmer and connect them more directly, kind of usher them into the 21st century and the free market. What is most concerning to me about the law right now is that there is a specific set of clauses that do not allow the farmer to litigate against a corporation if there's a contract violation, a contract dissolving, or some kind of abuse off the contract. That is terrifying. The fact that the government is literally writing into the law that if a corporation screws the farmer over in some way, they can't go to court about it. All my red flags go up. And I think thousands of lawyers and kind of attorney bodies across India have written to the government in rejection of those clauses, being like, it's not constitutional. It's not right. This should not be here. There's actually precedent for how it's been abused, where PepsiCo earlier this year tried to sue potato farmers, saying that the potato farmers were using PepsiCo potato seed for Lay's potato chips, but not actually selling the potatoes to them. And the farmers were saying, yes, we are growing potatoes. It might be from seed that we have saved over the years, but do you still have the right to seed that we bought from you 6 generations ago? And if you are only willing to buy our potatoes for a fraction of what they actually cost so that you can make Lay's potato chips, why should we sell to you? We need a price for seed that you gave us several years ago. We've seen precedents for farmers being trapped into these cycles where the corporation can screw them in really splendid ways. And so that to me is the really worrying part. And then the other issue here is that farmers were not consulted on these bills. And I think that's the base of what everybody can rally around. It doesn't matter what you think of the bills. I think we all need to agree on the fact that farmers should have had a seat at the table on deciding the agricultural policy that determines their future.
100%. So then is there representation right now? And are there people that the farmers have kind of elected as their own leaders, whether it's farmers themselves or certain members of the Indian Parliament that they feel that they're opinions and needs are being represented fairly and accurately? How does representation work right now, and how are the farmers communicating with government?
So it's a pretty convoluted, messed up system where there's supposed to be representation, but so many of these mandis, so many of these positions, you know, Modi's been in power a long time now, and something that his government is really skilled at is replacing powerful positions with stooges. We've seen that firsthand in Kashmir. Yeah,
with puppets, exactly.
We've seen that in Kashmir, where like every single minister position that could have been in opposition to the ruling party has been turned into essentially BJP puppets. And so dissent in Kashmir is not viable. And that's been a proven tactic. It's what Modi did in Gujarat too in 2002 and onwards. And so at this point, the reason that there's these protests and the reason that farm delegations are going to try to negotiate with the government is because so far they haven't been heard and there hasn't been the systems in place to adequately hear them. How feedback goes from farmer all the way to the top of government, how that travels is murky. I know enough to know that it's disrupted at many places. In this moment, there are definitely farm leaders leading the protest, going to negotiate with the government, but they've had several rounds of negotiation right now, and they've always come back empty-handed, saying that the government is not negotiating in good faith. They're making small concessions. But ultimately, when the bill was passed in September, the opposition was hugely against it, to the point where, so the way that the bill was passed, honestly, to me, is one of the most outdated, ridiculous things, where it was a shouting vote. So and they say, okay, cast your vote. And both parties have to scream their vote as loud as possible. I wish I was kidding, but I'm not. They have to scream their vote as loud as possible. Whether yes or no sounds louder, that's how the vote is determined. So it was a screaming contest in order to pass this bill, during which the cameras the chamber were cut so that onlookers didn't know what actually happened, which is also unconstitutional and illegal. And several opposition members are actually barred from entering the chamber. So the conditions under which these three bills are passed are archaic and hilarious and bizarre. I mean, hilarious in the most terrifying way that somebody can decide.
And also, not to mention a very like sort of heteromasculine.
Right, of shouting.
Of aggression, like where we kind of prioritize aggression as like a legitimate form of leadership as opposed to peacekeeping or as opposed to a more healthy form of negotiation.
And so back then, you know, the opposition really tried to take a stand and protest, but it was basically just some ministers posting on Twitter. And if no Indian mainstream media is going to pick up that dissent goes nowhere. And from there, farmers started protesting and it wasn't heard. So this bill, even just being pushed forward, was done in a way that should never have happened. And farmers are basically asking for the system to change completely so that they can have some power over the future agricultural bills of the country.
100%. So are people in India, is there a large activist community of young people and college students, folks who are, I hate the word ally, but let's say accomplices in the farmer protests? Are people showing up? Are people providing, you know, food and water while people are protesting, similarly to how we saw in the Black Lives Matter protests throughout the summer and fall of this year in the States? What is that allyship look and feel like, or is there opposition and lack of support for the 250 million farmers?
My answer is yes, which is that yes, people are supporting, and like I have seen amazing fundraising efforts around feeding the protests. The cutest thing that I saw today was like providing massage chairs to like the dadajis and the uncle-jis whose feet are hurting. And I was like, oh my God, this is so wholesome.
Damn, that brought tears to my eyes because I'm imagining my own grandfather. My dada is Sikh Punjabi. Both my grandparents currently live in Chandigarh, which is in the Punjab state. And sort of the image of like kneeling down and giving my grandfather a foot rub is very, that's very
Harsh. So, I mean, there definitely has been support. I have personally been surprised that when exactly a year ago when there were the anti-CAA protests and the protests against essentially the rising Islamophobia in India right now, my entire urban community mobilized. And I guess it was an issue around injustice that was understandable and deeply personal to the urban folks, like elite, middle class, across the board. That kind of Islamophobia was, it was easy to unpack and then protest against.
Why do you say that? Can you explain? Why easy to unpack?
We've seen the past 8 years, we've all seen the lynchings of Muslim folks, who's often Dalit folks, whose work is to deal with cows and the slaughter of cows or the leather tanning industry. Like the lynching around Muslims has been fairly documented and public knowledge across the country, as has the rise in the bullshit that is like this love jihad, or the idea that jihad exists as a mainstream concept.
Of course. It's an honor.
I think anti-CAA, urban folks were able to wrap their mind around Islamophobia exists. It's getting worse. We have a Hindu supremacist government that is now creating laws that will perpetuate this injustice. I think around the farm protests, I have seen support, but by and large, urban India, and I hate to make this generalization, but I'm going to, and like, if people need to come at me, that's okay. I can take it. I'm an urban elite. But we don't, as an urban elite, you don't understand where your food comes from. You don't really understand what agriculture in India looks like.
Also, that's because that was designed as a privilege. I think what people have marketed and packaged as the privilege of capitalism, the privilege of the Western world, is that you have no ties to the source of your food. And that's actually a good, that's a privilege, because you're so busy with
capitalism,
whatever else is consuming you in your life. Why would you need to know where your food is coming from? That creates the desensitization that we have to the average.
And who are the folk, who are the corporations that create that disconnect? It's the big bazaars. It's the Jio, Reliance Fresh, like the Indian urban middle class relies on these large corporation supermarkets in order to access their food, which has obviously taken them really far away from the source of their food. And then these corporations also own the media. So there's so many avenues in which urban folks have no access to understanding what is going on in Indian agriculture. And it's because it's the buffer of these same five or six corporations. So on one hand, yes, my super lefty progressive circles have been posting here and there, but you haven't seen the kind of marches in urban city centers that you saw for anti-CAA protests or even for Black Lives Matter here in the United States. And I think it's because of this, we're a young country, right? We're 80 years old, and prior to independence, we were colonized. And one of the biggest side effects of colonization was a real kind of failures of local sustainable food systems. We don't have that. Where we do have that, it's very rural. It's very distant from the urban population. So that's been the reaction in India, is my understanding. And obviously, I'm not on the ground right now. I'm sitting here in Oakland. So this is my read from far away. Mm-hmm. I would love to be wrong about this. Yeah.
But I think that apathy makes sense. Like, it's not even that radical of a statement that you're making. I think a lot of folks would do well to sort of check our own privilege. And
my expertise is in agriculture, and I still didn't understand this stuff until 3 days of like intense research and fact checking, looking through different news sources. So it's a very hard issue to tackle. It's very complicated. It's also why a lot of American leadership has been unable to make a statement around it, because it can get misconstrued in a lot of ways. I, as a spice company, I have a little bit more leeway to say whatever I need to say and like explain the nuance. We're privately owned. Yeah. Our farm partners back us 100%. I'm not super worried about like bucks or like Hindu supremacists coming after me. They already do. I just have a little bit more liberty to say this stuff.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you experienced any kind of trolling directly on your own social media?
And if so, yeah, it's every day. It's all the time. Most folks who speak out against the current administration face this. And I'm very lucky in that I haven't faced it to the degree that I've been barred from entering the country. It's mostly been on social media, which is that BJP supporters, Hindu supremacists. You think of Hindu supremacists the way you think of white supremacists, as like proud boys and stuff.
Right.
And it looks like your uncle, or like you and me, you know, totally. An auntie that you didn't know held her father's like deep-seated bitterness around partition. Wow. And like, it's all bubbling over now. Or like our neighbors.
Wow.
It's much more insidious than we think. It's not as hugely polarized in terms of class and caste baselines, or caste definitely. It's all upper caste Hindus. But my interaction with this has largely been as a visibly out queer person, and I spent half my year in India. There is a lot of online violence around being queer, around being, you know, being a freak, being all of those things. And of course, like, I have amazing or cis privilege here. I'm also straight passing as a femme. So there's a lot of privileges, but it means that you're always at the risk of being severely targeted. And when you're targeted by white supremacists or Trump supporters in America, it's like three or four folks, or like maybe on Twitter, it's a little bit worse. In India, there's whole click farms dedicated to harassing essentially left-wing folks. So when you invoke the wrath of the Bhakts, as we call them, or like Hindu supremacist folks, you're invoking the wrath of like a Twitter farm or a click farm of 2,000 people. And suddenly you find yourself blocking people on WhatsApp and Instagram aggressively because they found all of your contact information. Used to have my phone number on my Instagram profile because I was a photographer and like used to book gigs. So one fine day, a buck found me. I think I had put something in terms of like it being Pride Month and Eid at the same time, found me. And suddenly my WhatsApp, it was like an onslaught of like 500 different WhatsApps. So yeah, it was really special.
Have you found that you've had to distance yourself from like certain loved ones?
Being queer, I think that that was already something that I came to terms with in 2016 when I came out. My mom, before we meet family members, she messages them saying, just so you know, Sana is openly gay and is in a serious partnership with her female partner.
Wow.
And if you're okay with that, we'll see you. She's come a long way.
Your mom is amazing.
Yeah, she's special. Long time. It definitely took like 3 years of work and she's come a long way, but she is my feminist hero in a lot of ways. But and she's like, you know, if you're okay with that, we'll come see you. And if you're not, no worries. Like, we'd rather not interact with you. And so she protects me a little bit from those interactions by starting that conversation and in a way with my permission, outing me to people so that I don't have to deal with them personally. And so, yeah, there's been aunties who I was very close to who suddenly don't give a shit about me or who don't want to see me. When we go visit our family home in Ahmedabad, there's a lot of family that I just don't get to see, which, yeah, really, really hurts and really stings, but it is what it is. So I guess that initial hurt has kind of then paved the way to our politics as queer people.
Being more resilient, also being more resilient from situations like this where your politics are getting more and more radical. Right. You know that you're on the right side of history.
Yeah. And I think also in my case, having parents who share my politics is so unique. Most of my friends in Bombay have conservative parents who completely disagree with their politics. I mean, my dad was responsible for organizing this anti-CAA protest in Bombay. Like, he led that shit. So yeah, I feel lucky to come from a fairly radical family.
Wow. Okay, so let's take us home. So where are we at now with this protest? And what's the path forward? What are farmers asking for? And what's your personal opinion on what Modi and the government will actually concede on, what you think will be performative as opposed to genuine?
There's been several rounds of negotiation. Farmers have come back every time saying that the government's not negotiating in good faith. The government's not actually rescinding the bills, which is what farmers want. They are willing to protest for the long haul and have kind of set up around the border, really saying we'll be here until we get what we need. My personal opinion on it is that there needs to be state-based solutions. This idea that India, this giant country, can have federally mandated agricultural bills that affect farmers across the country, that doesn't make sense to me. The country is too diverse. Each state has, I mean, shit, like each region within each state has such a variety of things that they're up against and dealing with. We work in Andhra, Kerala, Manipur, Meghalaya, Uttarakhand, Rajasthan and Gujarat. That's seven states. Every one of those states, I deal with a completely different issue. Like in Kerala, the huge problem is money laundering. In Andhra, the main problem is corruption and bureaucracy. In Manipur, the main issue is that the government controls all transport. So the issues are so diverse that they need to be dealt with in a diverse manner. I also feel that forcing farmers to go cold turkey, which is what this is, which is saying, you had all this support from the government. We bought all your grain at a minimum guaranteed price. Now, goodbye, good luck, fair weather. That's ridiculous. There definitely needs to be a movement towards direct trade and movement to being somewhat pro-corporation. Right. Absolutely.
And deeper reform,
but
not
slower
level,
reform too, like reform that can happen over 10 years. Why not try a pilot program with 20 Punjabi grain farmers where they are paid a certain amount to try this system out? And then if it works, you grow on it. These programs need to be tested much more deeply because India is at this tipping point where we are losing more and more folks from rural areas and agriculture to urban areas. And that's because agriculture isn't incentivized, isn't profitable. During the pandemic, because urban areas drained so quickly and went into lockdown, there was a huge flood of people from urban areas back to rural farmland. And so there's this huge opportunity right now, this minute, for those young folks who are coming back to their hometowns and to their villages and to their farms to be energized and to be told, here are resources so that you can then be the next generation of farmers feeding this country using indigenous grain, using indigenous farming techniques, using climate resistant farming techniques, drought proof farming techniques. This is a moment that a little bit of inspiration, a little bit of like resourcing these young farmers could change the face of Indian agriculture. And instead, feeding straight into what these five large corporations want from the agricultural sector is digging the Indian agricultural sector even deeper back past the 60s. It's a missed opportunity for me and our community of farmers who believe in natural farming, which is a mode of agriculture that's kind of beyond organic. The leader of the movement is a man called Subhash Palekar. So Palekarji runs this thing called Subhash Palekar's natural farming or zero budget natural farming. And the concept around that is that it's zero input. Everything that you need to fertilize your crop, you grow on your farm. Natural farming has spread pretty quickly throughout the country, but it's still pretty niche. And all of our farm partners right now are natural farmers. There's all of these fancy organic pesticides and fertilizers that are all imported or produced by multinational corporations in India. It's still a industrial solution as far as India is concerned. And the certification is really expensive and really out of reach because the certification in India was set up by Western corporations looking to get their Indian farm partners certified according to Western standards. The example that I often give is that my parents are architects and they are often pushed by their clients to get LEED certification. But LEED certification says that in order to be platinum LEED certified, which is the highest level of environmental building, you have to have air conditioning. And my parents are always like, well, if we're able to design a building in India for the Indian climate that is so well ventilated that we don't need air conditioning, it is so much more environmentally sound than an AC'd building. But then we are not eligible for this Western standard of environmental standards, which is just blows your mind.
Which is absurd. Right. Which is absurd. And it's also like taking something that's relevant in one context and making an assumption that that same,
which is exactly the organic certification in India. Like that's that example exactly applies, which is that it just doesn't understand the reality of an Indian farmer. And that's where natural farming is like a domestic indigenous solution for domestic farmers.
Amazing. And are people talking about it or is it still
it's kind of on the fringes. Like 6 years ago, when I first started talking to some of our farm partners, they were seen as the crazy ones. When I first visited our farm partner, Prabhu's farm, his cousins and friends drove by while I was visiting the field to laugh at us. They would like drive by, slow down, honk, whistle, laugh, and keep driving. And they knew him as like the clown. Now those same cousins and uncles and will drive by, slow down, come out of their car, look very shy, and be like, so madam, will you take from us this year? They have come a long way. And I think you know the one natural farm in a village can over time really transform the view of a village, but it will take a lot longer to become seen as a mainstream thing.
Wow. Wow. Okay, well, to close out, let me ask you, what do you think folks who are listening can do to step up? Obviously, there's spreading awareness around social media, but are there any kind of global efforts right now? Is there petitions we can be signing that are being put forth at the UN? Are there places that we can be raising money to assist? Like, what are some of the international activists?
Yeah, so there's an organization called Khalsa Aid that has a USA chapter and a UK chapter. And my understanding is that Khalsa Aid is definitely one of the best ways to donate right now because it's donating directly onto the ground in Delhi and like essentially keeping the camps and the protest camps running. So Khalsa is a great way to donate. In terms of petitions and social media, firstly, like, do your homework and be careful before you repost things. There's a lot of fake shit out there too right now. I think what we don't understand is that when we repost something that's fake or doctored, it validates the right.
It validates it.
Basically the government saying that, you know, here's the rubbish that, you know, the lefties are perpetuating. So we have to be really careful that this movement isn't co-opted right now, and that falls on us to fact check. My big learning from this is what I have struggled for the past 3 years, and what's been my uphill battle, is explaining to people why they should give a shit of where their spices come from, or why they should give a shit of like how sourcing is done. 70% of the world, especially the West's spices, come from India. Everybody's turmeric lattes.
That's like your turmeric lattes.
Everybody's lentils. Everybody's Himalayan pink salt. Everybody's basmati rice. Like, no matter where you're buying it from, no matter how cheap it is coming from an independent Indian farmer who is not making enough money and who has been systematically, historically oppressed, starting with colonialism all the way to today. And I think the understanding has been like, oh, well, you know, it's cheap because it's coming from a country that the cost of labor is cheaper, or it's cheap because it can be. There's all these excuses, I think, that we have made up around why something is okay to be inexpensive, and that the more expensive option is all marketing or total bullshit. We get so many questions of like, why would I pay 10 times the price for your cardamom when I can just get cardamom at Whole Foods? And I'm just like, well, first of all, your cardamom has probably 10 times or 30 times the pesticides that ours does. And then also the farmer that grew your cardamom probably hired labor that was migrant or Dalit and like was paid below the poverty line by a lot. There's so many layers to this. And so really starting to seek out where you're sourcing from becomes important. I have pushed always that my job is to make sourcing sexy again and tell that story, not in like a condescending way. I think often the way it has been done is, look at this hardworking brown farmer who you're helping to send to school by buying this. Like, that's the charity model. That's the model of like,
and instead of realizing that like Western rhetoric,
we as Westerners, including myself, our ancestors have perpetuated these systems for generations now. And we have an opportunity to write those systems and not take credit for writing them, but just do it because it's the right thing to do. As you were saying, like right at the beginning, that what's most important for people to understand is that there can be a triple bottom line, like a bottom line of equity and justice built into capitalism and built into business. That doesn't mean I think that capitalism is the best way, but it is the way that we have right now. And there are ways to make it work better for us and perpetuate less harm.
Can you tell folks your website where they can be buying these kinds of spices in a more ethical way? And are you guys on pause?
We're not on pause because it doesn't really affect us in our supply chains. Our farm partners sell directly to us in Mumbai. Like, they just truck or ship product from their farms to our warehouse in Mumbai. And then we pack it and sell it directly to the consumer here. So because our supply chain is so short, in this case, it hasn't been disrupted. Like, early days of the pandemic, it was highly disrupted because we had to keep our farm partners safe. But yeah, you can find us at diasporaco.com. We buy a super fresh harvest from a farmer. When it runs out, like, that's it until the next harvest comes in. So if you see things that are out of stock until the next harvest, that's because we're essentially bringing a level of freshness to this supply chain that has never happened before. And yeah, come buy some spices.
What a concept that we assume that all the time fruit and vegetables should be available to us at every single moment of the year. And the funny thing is that the joke is on us, because I really do believe that the human biology is designed to connect with nature in a way that is cyclical. So we should be having certain things during certain seasons and then having other things during other seasons. It just makes total sense. Nature has designed it so beautifully based on where we live. So that's so exciting. The
seasonal pattern,
follow a sort of normal.
We literally grow at the rate of agriculture. Yeah,
organic is the raw. Yeah, that's the wrong word, but yeah, seasonal. Amazing, Sana, and thank you, Hallie, at Future of Women, for bringing us together to be able to have this very important conversation at a time where I know folks are trying to close out this year and look for the future, but a fifth of the Indian population is in arms right now. So thank you for
and thanks for being such an amazing moderator, Kiran. You did a good job. Thank you.